Girl is here with her monthly collection of anecdotes, insights, and inspirational stories designed to tackle today's only remaining taboo topic, grief, with the one host who's been there and back, Christy Huckstadt.
Oh, yes, Paul, I have been there and back, and I am here today to share with you what I have learned from my journey. 3 years ago, my husband completed suicide by train, and after that, I set out on a mission to abolish the stigma associated with mental illness, depression, and suicide. And I'm here today to start that conversation that no one wants to have about mental illness, to pull back that curtain. I'm also a certified grief recovery specialist, and I have a book that will soon be released. And the title of that book is What I Wish I'd Known, Finding Your Way Through the Tunnel of Grief. My book will give you all the tools necessary to get through your tunnel of grief so you can once again live a happy, healthy life. I am an advocate for those suffering a loss of any kind. And when you think of grieving a loss, you usually think of death. But we grieve all different kinds of losses. You may be going through a divorce, a breakup with a significant other. You may be sick and grieving your health, have lost your job, your faith, trust, identity. So these are all different things that we grieve. So I want you to think of this show as an online campfire where you can come for comfort and mainly to know that you are not alone. You'll find this a place for sharing and healing, and also a place where nothing is off limits or too tough to talk about. So let's get started with today's topic. Today's topic is depression. Is your sadness normal? Now, our guest today is Dr. Hoffman. Good afternoon, Dr. Hoffman.
Pleasure to be here, Christy.
And Dr. Hoffman is a doctor of addictive disorders. He's also a hypnotherapist, and he specializes in helping you move through loss. So, Dr. Hoffman, can you just give us a little bit of information of how you got into your field?
It was a long road that started, I guess, when I went to college. I was 18. I went to a journalism school, University of Missouri.
Okay.
And I worked in the corporate world, tried to live the American dream after I got out of school, but we all know how that goes. So I had my own experience with loss, with deaths, family members, my own struggle with addiction. And I realized I needed to know more.
Right.
I needed to know. I needed to go back to school. So I was 55 years old, and I went back to graduate school to get into the therapy field.
Let me ask you this. We all experience bouts of sadness, and that's normal. And we will continue to do as human beings. But at what point is our sadness considered unhealthy?
And that depends who you talk to. If you go to a clinical psychologist, a psychiatrist, a marriage and family therapist, they diagnose you with either major depressive disorder or dysthymia. And then that's a clinical diagnosis that's pathological. It's like saying something's wrong with you, when what's really happening is you're going through an emotional process. So being depressed isn't a life sentence. It's a process that you move through, and the idea is you learn through the process. So in my work, I don't believe in diagnosing pathologically. That's okay. Our whole, like all health insurance is based on that. You have to give a person a problematic diagnosis to qualify for the insurance coverage.
Right. Okay, so as far as the duration and intensity of your sadness, now I know for me, I was probably sad for and mourning for a year. Is there a formula of the length of time or the intensity of your sadness that correlates with depression?
There actually is. It's almost a spiritual answer. You will remain depressed, sad, isolating, sleeping too much or not sleeping at all, hiding away in the house, until you become active. you need to be back in the world because the grief situation happened that caused the depression.
Right.
But you can't sit inertly and be sedentary and fix it. So activity, social activity, exercise, all these kinds of things help you get through it.
Okay, so now we're getting to into the meat of it,
right.
What the real symptoms of depression are. And you mentioned exercise.
Well, that's a way to help heal it. But as far as actually the symptoms, we should get back to that. Symptoms of a major depressive disorder are feeling sad more days than not each week.
Okay.
Feeling worse in the morning, like when you wake up, oh my God, it's another day of my life, you know, that kind of thing. Loss of appetite. Isolating socially, staying home. Also having continually morbid thoughts, catastrophizing, not reaching out. And then the big problem starts if somebody resorts to numbing their symptoms with drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling. So pulling away from the world is the ultimate, it's the capsule symptom
right.
of depression.
Okay, so now there is a buzzword that we are all familiar with. Dopamine.
Ah, yes.
And dopamine is a motivation molecule. So if your dopamine level is low, how does that affect your brain?
Well, dopamine is a neuropeptide, actually. It's a fancy word for the kind of chemical it is.
Right.
That creates anticipation of a good result and anticipation of pleasure. When you're depressed, many people don't even think that they can experience pleasure, and that state is called anhedonia. Lack of pleasure.
Okay.
So when the dopamine is low, the only way to increase it is to do these things, I'm sure, which we'll talk about, which increase the oxygenation in your brain, the circulation of glucose through the brain, because your brain works on oxygen and sugar.
Right.
And activity is the big solution.
So there are chemical changes in your brain. A lot of people think, you know what, if I can just get my depressed friend out and get them socializing and wave my pom-poms, that should cure their depression. But there is an actual chemical response
right.
going on in your brain.
The brain responds to the anticipation of a new experience that
right.
will likely be pleasurable. Even when you're frightened, but you're, you know, taking a risk, dopamine is produced. So that's why if you want to help your depressed person best, show them, suggest to them, give them ideas about ways to be involved in activity.
Okay. What about serotonin? How is that different than dopamine?
Well, dopamine gets you up and going,
okay,
right?
Okay, right.
Dopamine sends you to Disneyland even though you feel terrible.
That's the motivation.
Right. Then you do the dopamine-inspired activity and the brain produces serotonin as a reward. That's like an anchor.
Right.
Hey, dopamine, I got what I wanted. I feel great now. And that's the serotonin talking to the dopamine. And then your brain remembers that loop. And that's why activities is beneficial, because you get anticipation of pleasure, the pleasure of the event, and the reward.
Okay, so can exercise actually raise your dopamine level?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's one reason. I've done a lot of work in prisons teaching meditation, and one thing I noticed, every prison mandates exercise because it's a mood elevator.
Correct.
The oxygenation of the brain is what you get from exercise.
And your diet, too, plays a major role.
Yeah. You don't want to be a real happy camper solving your depressive problems with Big Macs.
Exactly. So there's a lot of foods to avoid, the sugars, the...
Sugar, processed foods, fatty foods. You don't have to be, a naturopath to eat properly, but stay away. People know. There's not a person around that doesn't know junk from healthy food.
Right. And I do recall on Dr. Oz not too long ago, he had a guest speaker, Bruce Wild, and he has a dopamine diet, and just for the listeners out there, if you want specific lists of foods that actually do help raise your dopamine level, he's a great person to Google. So one other buzzword, and this is a big one, and this also relates to brain science, neuroplasticity.
Right. Big
what
topic.
Is that?
Well, have you ever had Play-Doh when you were a kid?
No, that was that was invented long after I was born.
Okay, the human brain has millions of neurons, okay?
Right.
And neuroplasticity is the ability of the brain to activate new neurons to do new jobs. This is why people who recover from strokes can learn to write or learn to walk again, because new neural pathways in their brain take over. The big study out of Harvard recently done on mindfulness meditation showed that 8 weeks of properly performed meditation have a neuroplastic effect, increase the activity in the prefrontal cortex of your brain, and that's where you're smart, the prefrontal cortex. Just
so
8 weeks.
So your brain actually does grow new neurons, and that will change your depressive behavior.
It grows new connections, yes.
Okay.
Yes, it does change behavior, definitely.
Right.
Scientifically, there's a good article in Biological Psychiatry by David Creswell. He's from Carnegie Mellon. And he did a similar study showing that people who cannot relax but spend some disciplined time in meditative practice can relax in situations that used to drive them crazy with stress.
Right.
And then they can make better decisions when they're under pressure, because more neurons in the brain are functioning to make good decisions.
Okay. Wow, that's interesting. All right, now, as far as behaviors that a depressed person should avoid, what are some things to stay away from?
A stressed, depressed person should not stay home in the dark.
Okay.
They should not resort to mind-altering chemicals.
Right.
They should not be sedentary. Just sitting around is deadly.
Right.
Okay. They should not engage in negative conversations with people who are going to get on the pity pot with them. Say, oh, you know, you did have a terrible experience, John. You'll probably never get over this. The wrong kind of sympathy is a terrible thing.
The wrong kind of friends.
The wrong kind of friends.
Right.
In fact, if you want to get over a really bad depression, get rid of half of your friends.
Right. And your family.
And your in-laws.
Right.
Get rid of your psychiatrist.
So just staying in positive social circles.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's this big study about resilience. And when a big trauma happens, about one-third of the people who get hit by a brick just respond with dramatic kind of reflexive energy, and they handle it. They surmount the obstacle. But the other two-thirds of people need to be trained.
Right.
They need to be told that they can learn how to be positive, how to open their minds, how to take some healthy new risks. But so resilience is a capacity of the brain, and if you don't have it, you can learn it.
Right. Okay. We're going to take a short commercial break, and we will be right back with our guest, Dr. Hoffman.
And we just want to remind you that today's program is sponsored by Rooftop Pilates and Lepo Skincare in Dana Point, the best reformer Pilates workout in the Orange County area. For more information on how you can get in the best shape of your life and have the skin texture you had in your 20s. Wow. Contact the Grief Girl at thegriefgirl.com. There's a 50% off coupon towards your first reformer Pilates session and facial for today's listeners. That's thegriefgirl.com to claim your coupon. All right, this is Paul Roberts, the engineer. Am I allowed to speak in this one?
You sure are, Paul.
I'm just listening to this in great intent there.
If you're depressed, Paul, just talk to us.
Just talk to us. I wonder how big. What are we talking about here? This is your first show in what hopefully will be a long series of discussions about grief. How big is the problem? Give us some overview of what we're talking about here.
Well, grief,
either one of you. I mean,
grief,
how many people suffer from
everybody,
it? Many,
everybody.
Everybody.
We all experience grief and loss. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Mm.
So you may have lost your dog, your cat. You may have lost your marriage. You may have lost your health. You may have had to recreate your livelihood and lost your identity.
Yeah.
It's called midlife crisis is the term for that. And we grieve all of these.
Is that why I bought that little red sports car?
That's exactly why we did that, the convertible.
Right. You're right.
Yeah. But we are not trained to think of those as losses. We usually associate loss with death. And that is not the case. So you wonder why you're sad, or you wonder why you have taken to all these short-term energy-releasing behaviors like drinking, drugs, shopping, workaholism. It's an avoidance behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the loss and the way we grieve, all of those skills and tools should have been taught to us as children, because we spend all of our life learning how to acquire things.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get that car, let's get that sports car, let's get a big house,
right.
Let's get that diamond ring. But we have not had any schooling or preparation in what to do when we lose things, even though loss is inevitable and oftentimes predictable. There is no training.
Hmm.
So that's my mission. That's why I'm here.
And why do some people, the doctor was saying, some people react and rise to the occasion. That was what my parents... I'll disclose. I went through a severe depressive episode 20, 30 years ago. I guess I was about in my 30s, so 30 years ago. Yikes. And I really was... It just knocked me for a loop. I got to the point I couldn't get out of bed. I didn't want to do anything. I even thought bad thoughts. You know, I was very upset about it. And a lot of things sort of hit me all at once. And everybody, of course, my loving family said, suck it up. Everybody just said, come on, you know, snap out of it, suck it up. Why can some people suck it up and snap out of it, and why are the rest of us devastated by it?
You know, there's a lot of research on that, too, and it comes down to primarily how you are raised.
Mm-hmm.
The family of origin, if it's a family that takes care of business and supports one another and has unconditional positive regard for helping each other and is encouraging, then children introject what they see when they're little. And if what they see is optimism and fortitude and resilience, then their brain develops that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
If they see the opposite, you know, mom's in front of the TV eating bonbons and dad's, you know, throwing monkey wrenches in the garage... And they don't talk to the kid. The kid thinks he's worthless and life's bad, and the kid is as depressed as his parents. And sure enough, Christy's right, in school, you don't take happiness class.
No.
You take algebra. I have used algebra every day since
yes,
never.
We're using it right now.
Yeah, it's silly. So the family of origin is very critical. There is research into a DNA marker for tendencies toward depression.
That's what I was going to say, because I read after I went to a therapist and other things, so, well, some people just have more tendencies. It's in your makeup. Yeah. I mean, some of it's nature and some of it's nurture.
Nature and nurture. And this is the cool thing about resilience, because you can learn to be resilient. If you don't know how, see, that's the job, Christy, that you do so well in your professional work, is you teach people what to do about this problem when they have no idea, when they come to see you, how to even start.
Right. They're not even aware that they have an issue.
No, they go by this pathology model of Western psychology that everything's pathological and it's a problem, you have to fix it. But that's not true. It's, you know, Carl Jung was so great when he broke with Freud, you know, and said, you know, people have a soul, they have a spirit. This is what we want to encourage when we do therapy. And you know, therapy, the word in Greek is two separate words, therapoien. That means to take care of the soul.
Mm.
Isn't that a cool word?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting, Paul. And I think for you, and I'm just speculating,
mm-hmm.
for men.
I'm going to get the couch out. No, it was very devastating. And I grew up in the Midwest, and people are
as
tough.
Did
and my dad fought the war and went through, was a bomber pilot in World War II, and he was in the Depression. And he never had said, I never had time to be depressed. I never had time to do this stuff. It was survival. So. And he learned to just bury everything, suck it up, and
but
whatever.
But see, we were taught that by our parents, mm-hmm. and they were taught by their parents. So there's
right.
at some point when that has been passed down from generation to generation about how to feel, how to care, how to express your emotions, somewhere along there we need to break that chain.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I will say, for my husband, who was in his early 50s,
mm-hmm.
I knew he was depressed. I didn't understand it. But he never said, I need help.
Yes.
He didn't share his feelings because he was this big, strappy, bodybuilding,
yeah.
you know, fitness professional.
Guys don't do that. And he found it probably embarrassing. He couldn't admit that I need help because I'm not supposed to need help. I'm the big, tough guy.
And that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about trying to abolish that stigma. So people that need help and suffer just like Bill did won't be embarrassed to reach out and say, you know what, I'm not okay,
right.
and I need help.
Right.
I remember this course about trauma and PTSD in grad school,
mm-hmm.
and there was a psychiatrist that worked with children in England, John Bowlby, and he saw these kids, by the time they were 10, they were like mini versions of their depressed parents, and they couldn't see a way out, and he said... He asked this one kid, I think was 12, he said, what do you feel like staying at home with these people all the time? He said, well, you know, I'd rather be in hell with the devil that I know than in heaven all by myself.
Ooh, wow, wow.
You see, and it's being afraid to think differently, that could there be a possibility I don't have to suffer like this.
Right, and our healthy brain doesn't realize that somebody who's clinically depressed, their greatest fear is life.
Yeah.
Our greatest fear is death.
Yes.
But their greatest fear is life.
Sometimes it feels easier to die. Like we did a number of vet shows, and the high rate of suicide, particularly with the current crop of veterans who are going through 2, 3, 4 tours more than probably most people were meant to endure, and they're coming back, and a high percentage of them, a shocking percentage of them, are committing suicide. Because I guess to your point, that seems an easier out than living.
Absolutely, and 80% of all suicides are completed by men.
Wow.
Women are four times more likely to attempt. It's more a cry for help.
Mm-hmm.
But men are the ones that are not expressing how they feel and therefore not getting help.
Wow.
Christy, I want to ask you something. I think you told me before, you tried really hard to go to all kinds of sources to get help.
Yes.
We're going to get you a little closer to the mic there, too.
Yeah. And what happened? What did you find or not find?
You know, I went with Bill to 3 different psychiatrists. We went to a church counselor, we went to a psychologist, and then we went to the mental health facility in Santa Ana with the county.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get at the time, because I was not familiar with depression,
mm-hmm.
I assumed that a psychiatrist was going to fix him.
Mm-hmm.
We spent maybe 10 minutes at 3 different psychiatrists where he was given prescription medications. And when they didn't work, we would go back, they would prescribe something else. So there was a medley of prescription drugs that Bill was prescribed.
And none of those doctors referred him to psychotherapy?
No. As a matter of fact, one of the doctors actually said to him, you know what, Bill, you're just being lazy. You need to get off the couch and get to work, get a job at Starbucks if you need to.
Oh, my God.
And you are fine. And during that session, he had asked Bill, do you have suicidal thoughts? Do you have a plan? And Bill looked at me, because I think he was about to lie, and he said, yes, I am suicidal. And I know now that it is the doctor's responsibility
right.
to call 911.
Yeah.
It gets so sticky. It seems in the psychiatric community there's a bit of a revolution going on about dispensing psychopharmaceutical
right.
drugs and in their little 15-minute sessions, but not making sure that person also finds real therapy. This great Michael Sugarman writes for the Journal of Mental Health, and he's got a good buddy named Joanna Moncrief. She's a psychiatrist also. She wrote The Myth of the Chemical Cure.
Mm.
And he and she agreed on this point that antidepressant drugs alone are not valid.
Right.
You have to have, they have a place, but they need the support of a real therapist. You can't do a lot in 15 minutes.
Well, you can do nothing but ask for the symptoms and then match the symptoms with a pharmaceutical, right? So
right.
A psychologist is the person that does the actual talk therapy, correct?
Right. Yeah, psychiatrists are medical doctors who are trained in matching chemicals with symptoms. Hopefully a chemical will change a symptom. A clinical psychologist, a marriage and family therapist, an addiction person like myself, a grief professional like yourself, knows to help the person look deeply at the root causes of their symptoms, because the symptom's not the problem. It's the cause of the symptom.
Right.
And if you just mask a symptom and don't feel it, and if nobody tells you, you must go deeper, you won't. You'll be like that kid who stays in hell with the devil that he knows.
Right.
So what do you... I'm hearing a mixed bag of impressions about pharmaceuticals here. In my own case, I went to a therapist who was not a psychiatrist, and we talked about, you know, where is this coming from, and bit by bit you realize that, at least in my case, I was doing a lot of this to myself, expectations and other things. All these things that sort of crashed at once, and I was like... I was, which is hard to admit, I'm doing a lot of this stuff to myself here, rather than just accept it and let go and accept that you feel sad and all these things. And at some point then I said, you know, gee, I just wish I could get back up on my feet again. And she suggested that I took Paxil or something here. And so I had to go to a psychiatrist. Somebody else to prescribe that, which I thought was kind of weird, because I just walked in. He said, "What do you want? I'm going to give you Paxil." He didn't ask me any, hardly talk to me about anything. He just sort of, I paid him $100 just to get a prescription or something here.
You hit that right on the head. I think everybody ought to pay attention to this website called Mad in America,
mm-hmm.
It has a partner website called Shades of Awakening, and the writers. At these websites are psychiatrists and clinicians who are questioning the validity and the proof that psychiatric medicine by itself is a valid cure for anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what are long-term effects? Well, a lot of these meds haven't been around long enough to have a long-term histories. And a psychiatrist will say, well, you need to take Effexor. And meditation, I don't think you need to do that. That's alternative.
Well, and if you hear about the side effects on TV, on these commercials,
stroke,
insomnia, it's ridiculous.
Well, it gets down to a real simple fact. If you look at some of the healing techniques, therapies that the medical community calls alternative, yoga is an alternative.
Right.
Meditation's an alternative. Reiki is. These. You know what? Those things have been around for thousands of years, and pharmaceutical drugs are about 100 years old. The meds are the alternative. The other things are classic. So people just need to investigate this and educate themselves.
All right, well, let's take another short commercial break, and we will be right back with our topic for today, depression. Is your sadness normal?
And we just want to point out that if you want to know more about Christie's soon-to-be-published books on grief, her book for you and tools for dealing with loss of any kind, What I Wish I'd Known, then you can find your way through the tunnel of grief, and her book for teens and their families, Are You Okay? All of these are coming out. They're all outlined in great detail on her website. And the website is thegriefgirl.com. All spelled out, thegriefgirl, thegriefgirl.com. RecoveryWork.com. You can also check out a recovery work with addicts, grief recovery counseling, talks about depression, what we're talking about today, and suicide to high school students, and her mental health blog for the Huffington Post. All that and more, just simply visit thegriefgirl.com. All right, so I'm still confused. So are pharmaceuticals good or bad here? I will say in my own case it did help dramatically.
I'm sorry.
And as the therapist said, or as the psychiatrist said, it isn't a happy pill. This is the point I had to get in my mind. It wasn't a happy pill. It just made you more elastic. It made you handle... It took off some of the highs and lows. I'm Irish, so I suffer from these real highs and these real lows here. It's culturally, that seems to run in our culture and our family here.
And that's really the point we're trying to make. For you, it worked. We are not prescribing anything across the board. For my husband's case, I think it was a huge factor in his suicide.
Wow.
He was prescribed all kinds of different medications for sleep. He was taking Valium and Xanax and Klonopin. And we would go back a week later, and that wasn't working. He still couldn't sleep. We were prescribed something else. So I think that cocktail of medication is a big part of his suicidal ideation.
Wow. You mentioned he didn't do any counseling in conjunction with that, right?
We did go to a psychologist. It was mainly psychiatry because, as I will admit, we both thought that there was that magic pill.
Yes, right.
And that when we found that magic pill, he would go back to being himself and go on with our lives.
I want to be really, really clear that we're not discrediting the psychiatric profession. It needs to be examined. And people, you know, like Sugarman and Moncrief, they're both psychiatrists. And Robert Whittaker, who founded MAD in America, they're saying, look into what you're prescribed. And if you have symptoms bad enough that a psych med calms you down, that's okay.
Right.
It's probably, according to them, not okay alone.
Right, in conjunction with other types of therapy.
Right, so I was going to therapy too as I did this.
Correct.
I think that's a key thing. Now, here's what I don't get. This is my question. Why do I pick? I'm depressed. Do I go to a therapist or do I go to a MD psychiatrist?
Well, here's the problem you probably have, like most Americans. You have health insurance.
Yes.
And your health insurance tells you where you can and can't go. Now, to qualify to be on an insurance list, you have to have a state license as a marriage and family therapist, a clinical psychologist. Then the medical board licenses psychiatrists. But what if you wanted to learn something Eastern. You wanted to learn yoga. You wanted to learn mindfulness meditation.
That wacky alternative stuff.
Yeah, that crazy stuff that's only been around for 10,000 years.
Right.
You can't get that service under your insurance in most cases.
Right.
So I advise people to step outside of this insurance box and open their minds to possible value of the so-called alternatives. And, you know, this other thing. Find a therapist who you're comfortable with, not just someone who will take your $25 copay. You need someone that's like a grandpa or grandma sitting there letting you
spout out.
Yeah,
yes.
They can listen and they create a safe holding space for you, but they also call you on your nonsense. You know, when you're really off track and being irrational, they'll point out distortions in your thinking process. And that's really the job of we counselors, is to show people things they can't see themselves.
Well, I think our main objective here is to open people up to new ways of thinking and feeling about depression. There are other things other than psychiatric or pharmaceutical drugs, psychiatric care, and talk therapy. There are non-pharmaceutical options to help yourself and do those in conjunction with everything else. And Paul, let me ask you this.
Sure.
Did you have trouble sleeping when you were depressed?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I had everything.
Insomnia or sleeping all the time?
I was more sleeping all the time. Okay. Yeah, I would just, I felt I didn't want to get out of bed. So I would just be, you know, it was hard for me to get out and get back into the world and stuff. And my wife was just horrified. She's like, oh, you got a, you know, you got a job, you got other things to do. And I'm self-employed, so I didn't have to call in sick or something. But I was, my business was disappearing and other things were happening. And it was just really just a combination thing. One of the things that the therapist told me that was such an insight, she said, you know, you grew up in this world where everything's, you got to be tough and you got to hold it all in. And it's, when it's the Midwest, we don't hug, we don't talk, we don't do any of this type of stuff here. And she said, I don't know that you've ever learned to feel. And I was like, wow. And I said, what do you mean I feel? I feel everything. I feel this. I feel sad. I feel pain. Mm-hmm. She says, but you think it's like, you can't accept that you just feel sad. And I thought that is such a revelation. And I think I've carried that through all the years. And I think our whole society, we can't feel sad for 60 seconds. I got to have 5 ways to fix my marriage, 3 ways to lose weight, 2 ways to get over a depression. I got to have an instant pill, instant answer. We live in a 60-second society. That's my little soapbox of the day here.
You hit the nail right on the head, that instant pill.
Yes.
And what we are trying to let our listeners know is there is no such thing.
Yes, and I had to learn that too. And they had to say, so this, you have a tendency towards this, you're going to have to deal with it like an alcoholic or something else. You're going to have to face that, you know, you have a tendency to slip into this type of thing for whatever reason, background or DNA or cultural heritage or whatever it is. And so, but it's okay to feel sad. It's okay to,
you know,
do
there's
something.
A name for that. What's a clinical that? Name for men who can't feel.
Really?
Yeah. It's called alexithymia.
Ah.
That's me.
The inability to identify and express difficult emotions. Now, I just call it the John Wayne syndrome.
Yeah, right. I'll tell you what, when I really know, she suggested that I go, we were trying different things. She said, why don't you go get a massage? I said, a massage? Are you kidding me? I wouldn't get a massage in 100 million years. My friends would laugh me out of the planet.
A stranger touching you.
Yeah, and when it did, it felt, one time it felt good, but it also felt very bizarre.
Meaning?
Having somebody massage you, and the more I relaxed, it was like, ooh, I don't know, this is, ooh.
It's
this
touch therapy. It's very healing.
Very strange.
Somatics are the new deal, I'll tell you.
So let me just recap what we are talking about of six topics and things that actually work other than pharmaceutical meds.
Other tools in the toolkit.
Yes.
Here. Right.
So these are six. All right. We talked about exercise.
Right. And that and they made me do that, too. I wasn't into exercise, and that did help.
Okay. And everybody always thinks, oh, I feel so high after I exercise. I'm in a better mood. Mm-hmm. But there's brain science behind why this works.
Mm-hmm.
So the number one is the exercise. Diet. You know, if you're consuming huge amounts of sugar, junk food.
I was. I would grow up in the Midwest. I eat meat and potatoes. I hated vegetables. I wouldn't eat a vegetable for anything. And my wife finally convinced me. We found now I eat salads and all these other things, and that change in my diet was a big part of it, too.
It's huge.
So I did both of those,
Yeah, sleep. You were talking about sleeping all the time. There are other people that go the opposite end of the spectrum.
Right.
They're insomniacs. And when you are deprived of sleep, you are very irrational.
Yes.
You make poor decisions. You're almost can get to the point where you feel like you're insane.
Yeah, right.
A therapist.
I went to
talk
a therapist.
Talk therapy. You need to bring what is troubling you to the surface so that you can let it go and move on.
And that was hard.
Yes.
Especially you do it the first couple of times. You say, oh, my God, I'm paid, what, $100 for this or something? What did I get? You know,
right.
We just talked about my mother or something here.
Well, it's a start, but it's not going to all come together in one session.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time.
And you know what else was hard to overcome? Because I told my parents, I'm an only child, so I told my parents, you know, good boy that I am, that I was struggling and I was going to go see a therapist. And my mother was horrified. Oh, she's going to make you hate me. Well, yeah,
she's going to blame you.
Some of it was related to my mom. Sorry, Mom.
Right.
Some of it was there, and you knew it. And how she had dealt with grief and how she dealt with things and all that.
And
they were both so... They really were horrified that I was doing this.
But she taught you what she was taught.
Exactly.
It's...
Amen. Her mother made her feel guilty.
No one's passing judgment.
Yeah, right.
Nobody's blaming. It's just, like I said, somewhere along the line, you need to break that chain.
And when I told my friends I was doing this, they would walk away from me. You know, they would like, ooh, yeah, okay, that's great.
You need a therapist.
Yeah.
You must be really, really ill.
Yeah, why don't we get together next year, Paul?
Exactly, when you're all better. And there again is the stigma.
Right.
remaining socially active, isolating.
I probably wasn't socially active enough because I was working all the time. So.
Or in bed,
yeah.
Right. And then another one, too, is being out in nature. And I know, Dr. Hoffman, you were talking about the importance of being in green.
Yeah, there's a great book by James Pretty. It's Pretty Like Pretty, P-R-E-T-T-Y. Mental and Physical Outcomes of Green Exercise. Mm. Don't you love that title?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah. But, your blood pressure lowers in natural environments. You go outside here and stand at the corner of Bristol and Anton for an hour, and you'll be 200 over 150. So, in natural environments are big. There's one other natural environment that comes through practicing prayer or meditation, because those are now proven neuroplastic brain changers.
Right.
And you sit there with your own material. I think the best thing is to go to your therapist, let something out, and go home and sit with it in prayer or meditation. And it cooks your neurosis right to the surface.
Wow.
And when I was at Tihar Jail in New Delhi in India, we're teaching prisoners, and these are some pretty tough guys, 10,000 men in there, largest prison in India. And after meditation training, some of these men, they're called untouchables because they're bad guys.
And under caste society.
And the guards are kshatriya level, and they're not supposed to really even touch these guys.
Right. That's why
and the owners of the prison are Brahmins. And at the end of the meditation course, these prisoners and guards were weeping in each other's arms because of what they had felt and had come to see in themselves. And it had been released in the meditative process. I'll never forget.
Ooh, I'm getting a little deep intake, a little deep breath here, Sai.
Well, let's delve a little deeper.
Right after the next commercial break.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and we will be right back.
Just a quick note for those of you who want to find out more about Dr. Hoffman's practice. He specializes in addictive disorders, as he said, hypnotherapy, and helping you to move through loss. That's really what we're trying to talk about here today. How do you face loss and move through it? To learn more, you can simply contact him on the website Sober Buddha, just like it sounds, Sober, B-U-D-D-A, thesoberbuddha.com. Check it out. Give him a call. All right. I want to make sure we got that in there. So you want to delve a little deeper here. You're
Absolutely.
Already getting pretty deep for me here.
Well,
you're making bring up stuff I hadn't talked about in 30 years here.
Well, I want to talk about meditation because that is so misunderstood. Mm-hmm. I work with addicts in recovery, and part of their therapy is meditation. But meditation is such a broad topic. It's a buzzword like mindfulness, and people don't really understand what meditation is. And I know I've been working with Dr. Hoffman, and he studied in Burma, and he's an amazing expert on meditation. And he said something very interesting to me the last time that we met, and I said, should I tell these addicts to download Headspace on their app? And he said to me, would you tell your Pilates clients to watch you do Pilates? That is not meditation. You are not actually doing the work. So I want you, Dr. Hoffman, to talk a little bit about that concept and really what meditation is all about.
Well, meditation and prayer are actually very close. But the form I teach is Vipassana mindfulness meditation. Vipassana is a Pali word.
How do you spell that?
P-A-L-I.
Not Pali.
Not Pollyanna. But after you meditate, you'll feel like a Pollyanna.
How do you spell this Vali thing that you just said?
So it means, Vipassana means to see things as they really are.
Okay.
But how do you spell that word? So if we want to Google it.
P-A. Vipassana. Oh, okay. V-I-P.
V-I-P.
A-S-S.
Okay.
A-N-A.
I'm impressed.
All right.
Vipassana. So, the process is simply to sit quietly. You don't have to sit with your back rigid or anything. Close the eyes and focus on the breath. And as thoughts come up, which they inevitably will, you simply allow them to pass through. You notice them, but you don't dwell on the thoughts. and you return your attention to the breath. Repeatedly training your mind to let go of negativity and focus on what's really happening is I'm sitting here breathing. Mm-hmm. And over time, the effects are dramatic, as the Harvard MRI study showed. Increasing the neuronal capacity of the prefrontal cortex, reducing the production of cortisol, which is your stress hormone, comes out of the adrenal cortex, and lowering the function of the amygdala. That's the part of your brain that says, I'm in danger.
Yeah, the fight or flight kind of stuff.
The fight or flight thing. Right. There's a saber-toothed tiger in the den, but sitting still is not a Western behavior.
No,
we've got to stay busy.
No.
So the problem is people are thinking, well, I'll get a headset and listen to some flute music. But all that is, that's not meditating. That's not bringing
right.
your material up. That's listening to music.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend anybody who wants to learn formal meditation. And Vipassana is one style. Okay, that's Burmese. Zen is Chinese and Japanese. That's also very popular. Every really founded religion historically has a meditative practice. None are better than others. The first one I learned was from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Transcendental Meditation.
Mm-hmm.
The Beatles.
Yeah, in 1969, and I practiced that till 92, devoted to that. And that's a Hindu practice, using mentally repeating certain words. But if you want to learn a valid, authentic type of meditation.
Can I give you a couple reactions to that? Just
absolutely.
As somebody who's coming as being your guinea pig here and admitting that he went through a lot of these issues.
Yes, please.
My therapist did really simple kind of meditation just to kind of control your breath because I was having
yes.
panic attacks. That was probably my worst symptom. I would have these panic attacks. I felt like I was going to jump out of my skin and whatever. And particularly in confined spaces, an airplane or something, when I had to travel around a lot. And I was like, oh my God, how do I get an airplane? And so just to focus on your breath and to focus on just being still and all these things. And it felt so, again, wasn't used to feeling anything. It was hard. I wasn't conscious of my own breath. I wasn't, even though I'd been trained as an actor a long time ago, I wasn't living in the moment. My head was racing all the time of where I'm going, what I'm going to do next, when the plane lands, and all these other things. So I wasn't used to just sitting here in this second, not worrying about making it through the next hour, not worrying about what happens next. And that was very, very therapeutic, as was going out in green space. My
right.
exercise, I started walking outside, and it was amazing. I suddenly loved being out in the green. I was in a cubicle all day long. So all of these things, don't you think they're sort of symptoms of some sort of Western disease? We don't talk.
Oh,
we race all
the
time. We all these things you talk. We don't get out. We don't exercise. We don't meditate. We don't do anything.
We don't sleep. We don't eat right.
Yeah, we're on the go. We're on the race. It's hurry up. And give me a quick pill and just keep me going. And it seems like that's you just defined the Western disease.
You know, there's the Cree Indians.
Mm-hmm.
When they encountered us way back when, they had a word for what they called the white man's insanity, and they called it Wetiko, Wetiko. And the Indian said, this will kill us. This is deadly. So a good friend of mine, Paul Levy, has written a whole book about it called Dispelling Wetiko. And it talks about this Western avarice, greed,
frenzy,
inability
right.
to
quick pace,
relax. And you sit and breathe, no matter what drifts through your head, what's really happening is you're breathing.
Well, and I think to put it all in layman's terms, really, you can only be as anxious as the depth of your breath. So if you're, let's say you're a Toastmasters and you have to get up in front of a group and give a speech,
right.
why, we don't even, subconsciously we don't know why it's instinctual to take a few deep breaths because it will calm your body down, which in turn reduces your stress level.
Mm-hmm.
That's why if you're trying to get to sleep at night, to practice meditation and deep breathing calms your central nervous system so that you can get to sleep. So,
and I was pleased to hear you say that prayer can be part of the two. I was raised an Irish Catholic. I'm still a I still go to church. I'm one of the few out there that hangs in there, despite all the craziness. And I found that that really was a source, too, that I could find a way to just pray more. Praying can be like meditation, too. Maybe that's another way of looking at
it. It's a very, very, very similar contemplative prayer. It's something I want to study more. Richard Rohr is a... I believe he's a Carmelite, and he teaches long retreats. I think I might go add that to my quiver.
And it wasn't. I was taught to pray. You sort of pray for things. It wasn't that kind of prayer. You know, don't please God. I'll do three Hail Marys, and this
right,
will go away.
And in return, you will help me.
Yes, right. It was really more like that. Really contemplating and trying to see if you could sense, is there really a God? Is anybody talking to me? And what do you say? The all these type of monks that. Trappist monks and stuff to talk about getting in touch with, you know, allowing yourself to get rid of all the noise to hear.
Right, and that also goes in conjunction with the power of controlling your thoughts and power of positivity, and there's a million books on that.
Mm-hmm.
But in talking about the brain science behind depression, the power of positive thinking and neutralizing your negative thoughts also play a huge role.
Mm-hmm.
Both, you know, I think we're pretty much agreed we're not being negative about medication because it can be very helpful. But adjunct or conjunct treatment is essential.
For me, it took the edge off so then I could do all these other things.
Correct.
I could slow down, and then I could meditate and pray and be in the moment and control my breath and take long walks and exercise more and change. I was just so uptight that I had to somehow relax a little bit so I could deal with some
of it's one element, but it's not the complete
package. No.
You wanted to slow down, not stay down.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
This is going to come to some kind of, I think it's going to be an ongoing, I hope it is a constructive dialogue between psychiatry and the authentic mindfulness community, because if mindfulness does what the Harvard MRI study does or the biological psychiatry article purports that it does, it may eliminate the need for more meds, not all, but maybe it is a first intervention. Well, John, I see you're really stressed. Let's learn some meditation. See how that works. If you're still frantic, then we can see about adding medication.
And I know for me, I have a few clients who are CEOs of companies, and they do not want to calm down and learn to meditate and slow down because they're afraid if we go in there and teach their employees how to meditate, to exercise, they're not going to be as productive. And they equate that to loss of income.
They maybe should have paid a little more attention to Steve Jobs. He learned TM the same week as I did, but he went to Asia long before I did. He's a lifelong meditator, along with some other fairly bright people like Albert Einstein.
Albert Einstein did meditation.
He was an Eastern meditator.
I'm going to give you another weird example to go Google and look up. I saw a special on Gerald Levin, Levin. Who is he? He was the CEO of the worst corporate merger in American history, Time Warner, when Time Warner bought America Online. And that's considered the most disastrous merger of all time. It blew up into ruined the stock, ruined everything, ruined his career. And he was a real high-driven, powerful guy. Of course, got fired after the disaster of the whole turn on America Online was worthless and didn't integrate well. And now he and his wife have some sort of meditative retreat, and he's let go of all this stuff, and he talks about all that. And he said, I wish I had known this back then, because I was so crazy and so driven, and I couldn't see anything.
Right, but they had to learn the hard way.
Oh, he had to blow up a $1 billion company and ruin his marriage and ruin his life and everything.
And a lot of these very successful people in their 60s are having triple bypass surgery and all kinds of health issues. So that self-care needs to start early.
You know where it needs to start? Dalai Lama said this a couple months ago. If all the children in the world were taught to meditate in grammar school, war would end in one generation.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Right. We're a ways off from that, but...
San Francisco Public Schools, Oakland, Gardena here in SoCal are now teaching.
Extremely progressive.
It has a big effect on the rowdy kids.
But look at the media message. It's fast. It's now.
Right.
It's instant gratification. I want it now. And it's Donald Trump. It's loud and boisterous and bragging, and it's not at all about. Could you see Donald Trump saying, I gotta get in touch with myself, or I gotta slow down, or whatever. That's not the image that he conveys.
No, and with technology now, everything's faster.
Yeah.
So we're not slowing down by any means. As a matter of fact, we're going in the exact opposite direction.
I think Congress ought to have a meditation session when they gather
and that'd
the
be
Senate.
Wild.
I mean, they make the laws, and that's what ends up in schools.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. That's.
I'd say Buddha for president.
All right. On that note, how do we reach you, Doctor? How do we find
my website, soberbuddha.com. That's BUDDHA. And my phone number is 949.
Oh, I spelled it wrong. That's why I did
it
wrong.
I spelled it wrong. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
BUDDHA. Got it. Okay.
Phone number is 949-212-4149.
Okay.
If I don't pick up the phone, I'm probably just meditating, and
you're
I'll call you
meditating.
Right back.
Yeah, exactly. And Christy, if people are suffering, if they want to start the conversation, if they want to, there's somebody right now who's hearing this today live or later as a podcast, and they say, they're describing me. What do they do next?
Visit my website, which is thegriefgirl.com, and you can leave questions, opinions, anything you want, and I will get right back to you. That's thegriefgirl.com.
Can they rant and rave at you and say...
They can do whatever they want. And what if you are out there listening and there are some topics about grief, mental health, suicide, that you would like to see covered, share that with me as well.
Yeah, let's get this stuff out in the open.
Absolutely.
That's what intrigued me about bringing this show to the station here, is to OC Talk Radio, is that we don't talk about this stuff. This is really the last unmentionable. We'll talk about anything else in the world, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is fair game. You know, Bruce Jenner's transgender.
Now, exactly.
We can talk about anything. But
we're conditioned to that.
We still can't talk about grief.
Correct.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Christy Huckstadt. Stay tuned for next month's collection of anecdotes, insights, and inspirational stories to help us tackle the only remaining taboo topic, grief.
Only here on Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.